Accession number 17626, Thomas Lawton, Rail 11.
Mr. Lawton, Rail 11. Had there been any improvement in the weapons and equipment while it was in France?
No.
You were still basically...
We're still there. 1914 soldiers.
How long were you on the canal?
A matter of days. The outstanding thing about being on the canal was the number of refugees who were passing by. And it is possible that even my niece and her two daughters were among those refugees, because they left Brussels and they went with refugees. They walked all the way down to La Panne, near Dunkirk, just in time to see the last British ships going away. And Chrissy says, and you know, Uncle Tom, you had to have a password. And the password was good night. And she said, we saw all these English soldiers lying there, and we said good night, and nobody spoke. So we said, well. And when we came back, they were still lying there, dead. And Chrissy always said this, she never saw a dead French soldier, Belgian soldier, Dutch soldier. But she says she saw an awful lot of dead English soldiers. And she said she used to nearly cry every time she saw a battle dress. Because there were people say she was born here. She left here when she was about 7 years old. Her brother was murdered while on convalescent from a hospital where he'd been wounded in the Belgian army. While convalescent, he used to come home. And he told his mother and them, listen, if ever I don't turn up, don't worry, I'll be in England. I'm going to get to England to join the British Army. And for weeks, he never turned up. Then on the BBC at 9 o'clock news, they heard this message. Hello, Mammy. Thomas has arrived safely home. He says, don't worry about him. He will be seeing you later. Now, there could only be one Thomas, that was him. Because, you see, while all the Belgians and the French said, Mama, they said, Mammy. And Dolly was even Mammy Dolly among the Belgians. So when the message came across, I want to speak to Mammy. Thomas has arrived home safely. Well, that was fine, all full of life. Dolly's husband that time was working somewhere else in Belgium. And about 6 weeks later, there was a knock at the door. When they opened the door, there's a Belgian gendarme and a German Schutz, a policeman. Madame Louis? Yes. You are English, of course? Yes. Even that was it. But she'd been there a long time. Do you know this man? That a young man with him? No, never seen him in my life before. Do you know that man? Thomas's identification paper. Yes, she says, my son. Where'd you get this? Off this man. Madame Louis, where is your son Thomas? He's in number one military hospital, Brussels, where he's convalescent after being wounded. Well, he's not. Thomas's body has been found by school children in a wood, semi-decomposed. And we need somebody to go and identify him. Never in the world. 22-year-old Thomas. They never knew yet who murdered him. But Dolly always had suspicion that it must have been a black market mob that he'd been with. And something had gone wrong. So that was 22-year-old Thomas. And within a year... I got word through the International Red Cross that my nephew, Bill Lawton, on leave from Africa, lived at Chester Street, had been found on the railway line, decapitated. He didn't drink, he didn't smoke, he loved billiards. And he used to go from home down to the billiard hall in Chester. And the last night he was there, he must have decided to take a shortcut across the railway near Chester Station.
Can we come back to the canal situation?
Yes.
Now, you say you were there for 7 weeks. The refugees were pouring through. How did that affect you, seeing all these refugees coming through?
It only interested me was I was looking for the yellow disc, because the Belgians and them, they license their bikes, you know, you got to pay a license. And I knew the Brussels disc, and I was looking for them, because I thought Dolly could have been among his crowd, see. Outside of that, didn't bother with.
Was there any warnings against Germans dressing as and coming through?
Oh, I had an outstanding example, as a matter of fact. In one place where we were, not on the canal, but elsewhere, we put a barrier up. And when I looked, I saw about five nuns on the side of the barrier. And I said, hey, they shouldn't be there. And I went up to them. And I told them, I says, you shouldn't be here. You should be that side. Eh? Yes, they were very nice. And the next time I saw them, they were this side, and they were going away. And it was then that we got word, be careful. They're even dropping parachutists dressed as priests and nuns. And these five people could have been exactly that. But we didn't know anything about that. But on the canal, we're there for 2 or 3 days. And then, quite honest, I couldn't tell you how we left it. Couldn't tell you. I mean, it was all chaos. We had no communications. We had no contact. And I was out on my own with a company of men. They were so frightened, I had to drill them daily to keep them together. They were frightened. Well, I mean, there were these old ex-territorials and reservists. But the point is, Sergeant Jack Tingler and I don't know how we did this. We got into civvies. And we were in a little place called Lillet. And the Frenchman come to us, there was thousands of Frenchmen there in the barns. And this Frenchman says, you are English. He said, be careful. I heard you speaking. Have you seen the notices around the town? Lillers. Notices to the effect, any military personnel found in service will be treated as spies and shot. Now this lad, this man, he said, I'll bring you a couple of eggs. We lived on rhubarb. And he brought 2 or 3 hard-boiled eggs. So Jack Tingler and I decided we must get out of that village. We're in civvies, remember. Seemed to be only one way. Went up there and there's 2 postons standing. And I said, just walk past them. Just walk by them. So we're going to walk by them. One says, halt. Way up. Went up. And of course you say, we are, who are you and we're going? Yeah. And although I didn't know it, I had a corduroy jacket on and there's a hole there. Could have been a bullet hole. And this German said something, and what he had said was, bist du verwundet? Are you wounded? And with him looking at that, he must have been attracted to the khaki short. Then he looked down, he saw the army boots. And he left with. And he went running into what must have been the commandant, and he shouted, the Englander is here. You know. And there's an officer came out, immaculate, as always. And he spoke perfect English. He says, hello. Hello, sir. And who are you? I told him. He says, but how do we know you're soldiers? And even if you are, you're in civilians. I said, yes, and that's why we're trying to get out. We've read the notices, at least, that we know that in French and English, But we are in service and we are soldiers. He says, you have been very unfortunate. Right. If you go down that road, you'll see a ration wagon standing with the man in charge. Go to that ration wagon and stop there until a mounted soldier comes along. And when he comes along, he'll nod to you. And then you go with him, but don't look as though you're with him. He will ride on the road, you walk on the footpath, because we don't want the French to think that we are arresting civilians. It's right at the beginning. Went down, the chap on the doors, he was only a Gefreiter, he only had two little stripes on. He says, you have been unfortunate. I says, you speak good English? Oh, yes. Educated in Cambridge. And in charge of a ration wagon. He says, you're hungry? Yes. He gave her a loaf between us, and he opened it in that patty stuff. He even spread it with his bayonet, and he gave her his coffee, his bottle of coffee. And just then the soldier came along on a horse, and he rode that way, and we walked on the pavement, and we went to a school in which there were prisoners of war. And when we got there, I said, bonjour. I was all the froggy, this, that, and the other. I said, don't be stupid. We're Englishmen, man. What? We're Englishmen. We went from there into the biggest field I've ever seen, full of soldiers.
Can we come to that later?
Yes.
Because we've jumped a little bit there. And this was obviously part of your capture situation. When you pulled back from the canal, you said you can't remember where, when, or what
no.
you were doing. What are your memories after that?
Well, no. Let's see if I can get away. My memories are very clear, but the whole situation wasn't very clear.
You were still in company.
We arrived in France. We were over the canal. Somewhere in the early hours, we arrived somewhere on the canal, you know. We were ordered to dig in and prepare for action. We did not need to dig in. We just cleared out old rusty tin hats, rifles, etc. from the First World War. And we settled down to wait for instructions which never arrived. Then we saw a movement on the opposite bank, obviously troops. We could see them and their helmets.
That was the other company that you referred to before.
Who were they? Should we engage them, thus drawing their fire upon us? No. Hang on. Wait and see what happens. Then we realized it was another company of our battalion who did not know we were where we were and we didn't know where they were. Right. This is after we see the refugees. From then on, we lost all contact with the battalion. How we moved, I do not remember. We had no communications. And eventually I found myself isolated in open country with a company of frightened men. We had no communications, and eventually I found myself isolated in open country with a company of frightened men. We could hear the noise of the Germans, tanks, etc., moving below us. But everywhere we looked, it was just going up in smoke. In order to try and hold my company together, I began to order them to form square formation, diamond formation, arrowhead formation, as we had practiced in territorial army camps. But my company was a rabble. Shortly after we had arrived in Frevant, the tented camp, Mr. Moscop began to disappear for hours at a time. And I said to him on one occasion, Captain Moscow, you'll go away one of these times and you won't come back. Where he foamed at the mouth, started yelling at me, what did I mean? And I told him what I meant. I meant you'll either get shot or you'll be taken prisoner of war and I won't even know where you are. This he poo-pooed. Nevertheless, the time came when I said to him about these linesmen, etc., etc. He took no notice. Then one morning at 6:30, The orderly sergeant came to my tent and he said Captain Mosscrop had left at 4:30 a.m. in the little two-seater car which we had. Goodness knows where it came from. He had filled the tanks with petrol and he'd stuffed cans of petrol into every available space on that little car. And he said he was going out to make a daylight reconnaissance, not to trouble me, until after Reveille. When the orderly sergeant told me that, I said to him, that is the last we will ever see of Captain Mosscrop. And it was. I was left with two young officers who somehow managed to get us lost. They could not even map read. No one knew where we were, not even on the map. Appreciating the situation, I decided to stop every possible British or French vehicle I saw. And I did. The first one that came along was a RAF wagon, on which was the battalion Padre, Ryan or something like that. I know he's a Catholic. And the driver, plus a load of officers' mess silver. The Padre said there was no room on that wagon for the men. I said that even if we had to throw off the silver, my men were getting on that wagon. I pushed 36 men into it, with Sergeant Tom O'Connor in charge, and I ordered Private Tommy Smith, who was at that time a British champion, a boxing champion of England, he fought Neil Tartan. I told him to accompany Sergeant Connor on that wagon. Smith turned to me and said, I'm not sick. And I said to him, if you don't get on that wagon, I'll hit you so hard, your grandmother will feel it. Get on that wagon. And all those men got home, because later on, Tommy Smith was working at the Army Schools of Physical Training in Aldershot, and they all got home.
Had you felt for some time that Mosscrop's nerve had gone?
You know, it'd be hard to say his nerve had gone. He wasn't that type of man. He wasn't that type of man. But he'd weighed everything up. And when I've looked at a map as to where we were in relation to St. Dunkirk and his places, I've realised how easy it was for him to just slip across into Spain. And you see, after the war, I learned that his people were farmers in Spain. Now, I got a letter from the war office after the war asking me if I could tell them where, when, and under what circumstances did I last see Captain Mosscrop. I told them as near as I could, and I also said, in my opinion, Captain Mosscrop deserted us when things got too hot. So that was the situation there.
Just before you go on, did anything come of it at all?
Never heard another thing.
But he had survived, got through, whatever.
Don't know.
He didn't know that either.
Never heard. In fact, sometime later I thought I shouldn't have said that, but see, I couldn't help but say it.
But someone was obviously investigating it at the end of the war.
Absolutely. Oh, yes. And you see, with him having gone so often and never said anything, after 2 or 3 hours coming back, at the finish I began to think, was he a fifth columnist? But when he went off on that daylight reconnaissance at 4:30 in the morning and told the orderly sergeant not to bother me till after Reveille, it was obviously he was away. And then later, when I learned from somewhere that his people were farmers in Spain, I said, that's where he's gone.
So you've got 36 men away on a truck.
I got them away without any trouble.
What happened to you after that?
Well, it just went out. I pushed the 30-odd men on there, diddle, diddle, diddle. And I said, I told Tommy Smith what I would do. I took account of the men. I had 75 men and 2 officers. I explained the situation. We were out of touch with the battalion. I was not too sure where we were, but we would travel westward towards the coast. Keep together as much as possible and ready for the unexpected. Suddenly, As if from nowhere, a British armoured car appeared. It looked like matchwood compared to the German armoured cars, and the officer in charge was surprised to see any British troops in that vicinity. He couldn't believe there was anybody there. Well, I said we were out of touch, we didn't know where we were, and he said he was there for one purpose. Orders are orders. He was told to stop there until his last bullet. In other words, stop there till the finish. And he said to me, if I wasn't under orders, I would do what I'm going to advise you to do. Get moving west as fast as possible, because the Germans are just over there. And when we left, I couldn't help feel sorry for him. He's driving a couple of men. And they were going to wait there, if necessary, until they were overrun or killed. And we start moving again west. He said enemy tanks were fast approaching our position. He was not too sure where we were because he was out of touch with command, but he pointed us to the west and suggested if he was not under orders to stand fast, that was where he would head for, and head for it very quick. We wished him the best of luck, and we moved out. Some men asked if they could travel in parties on their own. I said yes, but keep together as much as possible and keep in touch. I knew that the more isolated groups of men the Germans met up with, the more they would become confused. Hours later, and miles further westward, an army wagon appeared and pulled up. A sergeant and driver told us to pile in quick. Jerry was just up the road. We piled onto the wagon, all 35 of us. We've gone up to 35 again, see? We stood cramped together for some miles when I saw two young soldiers running behind us. I sent word forward to stop the truck, and in order to pick those two lads up meant that two of us would have to get off. It was packed. I told the two officers that myself and Sergeant Jack Tingle were getting off. Jack was a reservist. We were getting off so that those lads could get on, and they, in turn, were now responsible for that truckload of men.
Do you remember the names of the two officers?
One was a... Yeah, I can't think of his name. He came a farmer's dog, something like that. Bradford, he came a farmer's dog. I can't think of their names. No, I can't think of their names. But I told them they were responsible now for those men. And I know they all got back to England, because after the war, while having a drink in the local Catholic club, a man came up to me and thanked me for getting him home. And he was one of the lads which was picked up. And he said, so you became a prisoner of war? I said, that's right, through us getting off the truck. I said, not necessarily. But I said, if we'd stayed with the truck, we would have got home. But if we'd got home, we mightn't be here to tell the tale today. He said, thank you for getting me home. Sergeant Tingle and myself decided, heading west. After some time, we found ourselves in Bethune, where a woman advised us to get out as quickly as possible because the Germans were due any time. It so happened that we had discovered a wine cellar full of champagne, stacks of champagne. And what we did is we emptied our haversacks, filled them with biscuits from the shops, we looted them from the shops, and we had a tin cup, and we were feeding the old refugees on drinks of champagne and a biscuit from the haversacks. And that was in Bethune. And the refugees were pouring through there towards the coast. Eventually, we got out of Bethune, and in our haste, we walked across a footbridge right into the arms of a German infantry patrol.
Was this when you were in your civilian clothes? Where had you got those from?
What?
Is this when you had your civilian clothes on?
Aye. Oh, still the civvies.
Yeah. When had you changed from uniform to civvies?
Sometimes before the first time we were taken prisoner. If you can remember, I said we were in civvies when we came through Lillehurst. But the point was, before that in civvies, we were in a big field with all kinds of troops, including French colonial troops. And I said to Jack Tingle, there's an officer come. There was a judgment, walked out the gates, and they shot him just like that. That was a warning. Then I saw an officer coming towards us, speaking to different people, and I don't know how many Englishmen, if any Englishmen were there. There was Dutch, French, and the lot. And I said to Jack Tingle, don't forget, Jack, we are Irishmen. And this brought something on which Churchill had said. A lot of people don't realise that if the Americans had come into the war when they did, Churchill was getting ready to invade Iraq. He didn't trust them. He said that De Valera was a cheat, and he said they must have U-boat pens on the west coast. While they were sending information back about the weather, there were a fully manned German or Hitler embassy in Ulster, in Dublin.
Dublin.
And I always connect that up. The Irish would have loved to see us go under. And while today they won't talk about the Battle of the Boyne 300 or 400 years ago, the Irish also remember 1940, the potato famine, when 1 million people died and 1 million left Ireland. So they hold all this against us. Anyhow, the officer came along. We jumped up. And I said, good morning, sir. I said to Tingle, leave this to me. I've lived with Irishmen. I said, good morning, sir. He says, good morning.
This was a German officer?
Yes, oh, aye, immaculate. He says, you are Englishmen. No, no. I said, we are Irishmen. Irishmen. I said, yes. You are not of the French armies? No, sir, certainly not. We were working here in northern France. But, you know, you people came through too quick. We couldn't get away. And he was so pleased. Yes, he said, we did. Came through rather quick. Well, he says, you're not my prisoners of war. We're not. No, no, he says, Ireland is neutral. We are friends. And, you know, after the war, when I read about what Churchill said, this German officer says, so he said, oh, does that mean we can go out of here? Certainly. Ah, well, I said, where can we go? Now he says, you can go anywhere, but you'll never get out of German territory. We went across there into a little cafe, had a cup of coffee, we had it in one of the Franks, and the old woman realised we were English. She was dead scared, because across there was the German army, and it would have been more than her life was worth if that had happened. But that was when we first got into civvies.
Where did you get your civvies from?
From the house. That's where we got everything. See, everything was wide open. Shops, pubs, everything was wide open. They'd left. And so we just called it looting, if you will, but we went in the hope to get away.
So dressed in civilian clothes and trying to be Irishmen?
Oh, we were Irishmen. That's correct.
And this leads on to the story that we've already got on when you were at Lillet.
Aye.
And you got caught.
That's right.
Ultimately there.
That's right.
So what happened then after you got away from...
From Arras. No, the date must have been around about the 19th of May. We were picked up by some Germans. We couldn't show any identification papers. And we finished up in the citadel in Arras, which was packed, crammed with prisoners of war. And I said to Jack Tingle, Jack, if you see a queue, jump into it. Because it could be a soup queue. We jumped into a queue and it was a work party. And we were bundled onto a truck and taken miles away to a warehouse which was stocked with German war bread. And there were no Germans there. But that warehouse was packed with loaves of German war bread. We loaded the vehicle with war bread. And as we were coming back, we were throwing loaves off to the refugees. and we come up a T road coming back to Arras when we saw the columns of German armour moving northwards. I would think it'd be northwards. And I said to Jack Tingle, look at that. He says, the Germans. He says, they're on the run. I said, on the run? He said, they're on the run. And we joined that column on the run. And this was about the time when the British forces put in a counterattack, the only counterattack ever delivered. And of course, it fizzled out because it wasn't coordinated. They had no backings up. And we were then travelling with the German columns. Tanks were pushing wagons off the road and getting away over the fields. And I realised then that no matter how fast the German can move when he's advancing, he can move quicker when he's retreating.